I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Senate has handed President Bush a major election season victory, passing a detainee bill that sets up military tribunals for suspected terrorists and allows aggressive interrogations of top terror suspects. It also redefines enemy combatants to include non-citizens living legally in the U.S. The president says the legislation will help defeat America's enemies by allowing the U.S. to try terrorists. Democratic leaders say it threatens the foundations of the American legal system by stripping detainees of the right to habeas corpus. That's a bedrock of the Constitution that allows anyone to challenge an arrest or detention. Well, today we're going to look through that bill with a fine-tooth comb, but first, what it means politically. We start with Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, we've been speaking with you all week about this bill, and I want to start by talking about the right to habeas corpus, to challenge and know the charges against you. This set off some of the most impassioned debate on the Senate floor, we understand. Tell us a little bit about this debate until last night. Who was on each side? What did they say?
Well, this was actually one of the most compelling debates I've ever heard on the floor of the Senate, because it got down to bedrock issues. You had Senator Arlen Specter, who chairs the Judiciary Committee, against the leadership of his own party and against the White House, insisting that we are eliminating a core value that goes back to King John at Runnymede and the right to throw people into dungeons forever, that the Magna Carta is a critical part of Western jurisprudence and you treat it lightly at your peril. Now, on the other side, you had Senators John McCain, Warner, and Lindsey Graham, who stood very strong on this against Specter, challenging the Democrats just to come up with a reason why you should deprive the president of the tools that he needs to fight the war on terror. Graham said that all we have eliminated here is the right of a civilian judge to interfere with a military decision, to clog the courts, to distract from the war on terror. And the Republicans were confident that they could take this issue into the elections and that the public would be more concerned about safety than they would be about the rights of obscure detainees who they think mean them harm.
Well, in fact, some would say that this was the political strategy, that in fact the Republicans were hoping to lure the Democrats into this, you know, trap of, you know, voting against what is being pushed as a big, you know, anti-terrorism legislation. But 32 Democrats voted against it. What's your sense of, you know, how this may or may not be unfolding, how this may be playing out politically?
I think what it shows is that the Democrats are confident that, unlike election 2002 and 2004, where they took losses over national security, they can take this to the American people and win. It suggests a real confidence. Now, not enough to filibuster the bill. This they could have done. And one of the most interesting conversations I had was with Senator Dodd from Connecticut, whose father was involved in the Nuremberg trials. And Dodd said that it is curious that the Republicans would be using the Constitution as a wedge issue 30 days before an election that happens to be the 60th anniversary of the verdicts in Nuremberg. And he said this is a sign that we are stepping back from what we established at that time. Well, international law makes crimes against humanity important, and that he said by this bill, especially the habeas parts, we're retreating from that standard.
Well, given that, Arlen Specter, the Republican, had put forth an amendment which was shot down, questioning the rejection of habeas corpus, but then he voted for this legislation. Why?
Well, that's a very good question. I spoke to him just before the vote, and he said, I am not going to support a bill that's blatantly unconstitutional. This goes back to the Magna Carta. He said, I'd be willing in the interest of party loyalty to turn back the clock 500 years, but 900 years goes too far. I think what happened in the end was he is convinced that the Supreme Court will strike that bill down. And he's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. It means a great deal to him. The party could take that away from him. I think there was a great deal of pressure at the last minute for a show of party loyalty and force on this, to not undermine McCain, Graham, and Warner, to not undermine the president at a time when he's kind of taking this issue to the public and to just vote. And what he told me today is he is still convinced the Supreme Court will send this right back to the Congress and they'll have a shot at it again, that there was enough in it that he feels is possible, is positive, to justify his vote.
Gail Chadwick,
I'm surprised.
yeah, to say the least. A quick question in the minute we have. You mentioned the three renegade senators who had been against the president's plan to sort of undermine the Geneva Conventions in this bill. John McCain saying that the bill now protects the Geneva Conventions. We're going to speak to a military lawyer in a moment who says there are still loopholes. Did McCain win?
I don't think so. That is, he won what could be a Pyrrhic victory, not unlike the detainee bill that he won last year. We had a great victory celebration. You know, I wrote stories with everybody else saying that the senators had faced down the White House. And then the president, in a signing statement, basically said conditions could give him the authority, inherent power, to ignore the law. The same thing applies to this law.
Gail Chadwick, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. We're going to hear more about that. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And we turn now to former military attorney Scott Silliman, who is a professor at Duke University School of Law and has testified on these military commissions before Congress. Professor, politics aside, we'll get to the torture issue, but we want to go through the details of this legislation with you, starting with who can be detained as an enemy combatant?
Under this proposed legislation, any non-U.S. citizen can be detained. That means anyone who's outside the country who we might pick up on the battlefield. But it's very sweeping in its scope. It also provides there anyone who is a resident alien in this country, a green card holder. They, too, can be determined either by the president or the secretary of defense or one of these administrative tribunals to be an unlawful enemy combatant and be detained. So it can happen to someone right here in our country.
So people who are green card holders living legally in the U.S. Can be detained?
That's exactly correct. The only class of individual who could not be detained under this proposed legislation is a United States citizen.
Okay. Who would be detaining them? We should say we know the military already has 13,000 detainees in Iraq, 14,000 if you count worldwide. But the military just adopted rules banning torture. Would this law apply to military detainees or not?
It's more directed towards the CIA in its sweeping provisions.
Right. And where would these detainees go once they're taken into custody?
They could be taken to Guantanamo Bay. They could be kept at some site in Iraq or Afghanistan. There is no limitation in this proposed legislation on where we would keep them. I would suggest, though, from a practical reason for security, we would probably not try to keep them within the United States. They'd be kept outside our borders.
So does this legislation make legal the secret CIA-run prisons?
I wouldn't say that it makes it legal, Robin. I think what it does is it shields from prosecution, especially the CIA agents who have been interrogating these folks outside our borders. The shielding from prosecution actually is made retroactive to 1997. Military personnel, of course, are subject to a different criminal law, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So, again, this has less to do with the military than it does with the CIA.
Let's look at the president's powers under this legislation. What power would the president be given to interpret the Geneva Conventions, the treaty which sets standards for prisoner treatment? We understand that the legislation specifies torture, rape, murder, and any act that causes serious physical or mental pain or suffering as grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, but does it specifically ban any harsh interrogation techniques?
I don't think it does, Robin, and as the saying goes, the devil is in the details. The prohibition against torture, as defined in the Act, is very similar to what we find in other pieces of legislation and in international law. The real problem is the definition of cruel or inhuman treatment. In other parts of U.S. law, that's normally very specifically defined under the amendments to the Constitution, the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendments. But here it's defined almost identically to the terminology used to define torture. And it talks about serious mental pain or suffering. And the key to that with regard to an act such as waterboarding, Robin, is how long does that mental harm last? If it's considered to be only temporary or what's called transitory, then it would, in fact, not be a violation of the criminal law. So a CIA agent anywhere outside the United States who waterboards to get information, in my judgment after reading this text, would not necessarily be criminally prosecuted under this act as it's proposed.
So let's be clear. Waterboarding, which is the simulated drowning, loud noise, extreme cold. There was some talk that these would be banned by the new legislation after the three renegade senators balked at the president's request for a harsh interrogation. But you're saying in your reading that those would not be banned?
I think that's correct, Robin. I know what Senator Graham and Senator McCain said, but a very close reading of the text does not prohibit those or make them criminal. And that's up to the president to interpret and deal with, not the courts.
Oh, well, that's the second question. If a U.S. detainee feels that he did have long-term effects from, let's say, waterboarding, that he was disabled, permanently disabled, and it's not transitory, as you said, does he have the right to sue his interrogators?
No, he really doesn't, Robin. Under this legislation, probably the most controversial aspect and the one that erupted even yesterday on the floor of the Senate was basically jurisdiction stripping. It says that there is absolutely no right for anyone being detained by the United States as a unlawful enemy combatant to go in and seek what's called habeas corpus review in any court. That's to challenge the detention. Now, the only avenue possibly left for a detainee is to say, I am complaining about my treatment, not my detention. That has to be done through an administrative board down at Guantanamo Bay, and then there is a procedural review in the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. When I say procedural, the review in that court is, did this board follow its procedures? It's not necessarily a full decision on whether the individual was, in fact, subjected to coercive treatment.
Does that mean that a detainee, can't challenge their arrest ever?
That's basically the way it reads under this legislation, Robin. Now, surely that's going to be determined in legal challenges yet to come.
Well, and let's keep looking at some of the aspects of the law and how it would affect detainees. What happens with the evidence that's gathered against a detainee, especially if it's been coerced? It's gotten through some of the interrogation methods that are legalized by this legislation. Will that coerced evidence be accepted in court?
It depends on the date, Robin. If it was before the 30th of December, the date of the McCain Amendment, then only if torture was applied would it be prohibited. If afterward, then it's admissible unless torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment was applied. That's the test, the new test, but it only applies after the 30th of December of last year.
And that was the date when Senator McCain forced the debate in the legislation on the definition of torture and cruel and inhuman punishment.
That's exactly correct, Robin. And from that day forward, it criminalized cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, which was not done before that.
Scott Zilliman, a former military attorney and professor at Duke University School of Law. He'll be back to answer more questions. What about hearsay evidence in these military commissions? Or what happens if a detainee is cleared by a commission? Is he then released? Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with former military attorney and Duke University law professor Scott Zilliman, and we're parsing the legislation that President Bush is expected to sign that sets up special military courts for detainees suspected of terrorism. The courts would limit detainee legal access and rights, and Professor Zilliman, you mentioned evidence from coercive interrogations could be allowed in these courts. What about hearsay evidence? Can that be introduced into these military commissions, as they're called?
Yes, it certainly can, Robin. And it's a very flexible rule. It's supposedly the one that is used by the international tribunals. It allows hearsay evidence in, simply recognizing it's very difficult to bring a battlefield commander or a soldier 8,000 or 10,000 miles to testify in a court. So that's a very flexible rule, and that's something the government can use.
And that distinguishes this legislation from civilian courts where hearsay evidence isn't allowed. Does a detainee have the right to pick his own lawyer or defend himself or be present in court?
Well, he certainly has the right to be present in court unless he's disruptive or unless there's an issue of the safety of other witnesses. He is given a military defense lawyer to represent him. He can't have someone who is not a U.S. citizen. He can have a civilian defense lawyer who is a U.S. citizen accompanying that military attorney, but he doesn't have that same type of flexibility that you or I would if we were in the federal courts.
Does he have the right to see secret evidence, classified evidence against him?
No, he doesn't, Robin, and this was a big bone of contention. The way the act now sets that a classified document will be taken by the military judge, the judge of that commission, an unclassified summary of the operative facts, stripping out sources and methods and classified portions, and an unclassified summary will then be given to the jury but also made available to the accused. That's something that Senator Graham and Senator McCain fought very hard to get, and that's one victory for the Senate.
Mm. I want to go back to the point of habeas corpus, the right to question, to challenge a detention. You've said that there is no such right under this legislation. Does that mean that, and to be clear, that there may be detainees that will never go before military commissions? In other words, never get to challenge their detention and can be held indefinitely.
That's exactly correct, Robin. I think that we will see only 20 to 25 at most of those that we hold in detention ever brought to a military commission. The rest, under the laws of war, can be detained until the end of this war on terrorism, whenever that is. And under this proposed legislation, if they're not brought before a military commission, they have virtually no right to legally challenge that detention and may stay there as long as the war on terrorism goes on.
If they are not convicted by the military commission, will they automatically be set free?
No, they will not. Again, a conviction by a military commission is basically saying you are convicted of a criminal offense, a violation of the law of war. The 90% of the others that we hold are merely being held as battlefield detainees, unlawful combatants. And they may be held, again, without ever having a criminal charge brought against them until the termination of this war on terrorism.
But I guess my question is, but if a detainee does go before the military commission, is tried, mm-hmm. and is cleared of any charges against him, does that automatically mean he's released?
No, it doesn't, Robin, because that means he may be acquitted of the criminal charge, but that does not take away his status as an unlawful enemy combatant. And under the law of war, the United States can continue to hold him, even though he may not have committed a specific crime, until the end of the war on terrorism.
Which could last forever.
That's correct, and that's what's got many of the human rights advocates up in arms about this legislation.
Scott Silliman, again a professor at Duke University School of Law and a former Judge Advocate General, JAG, for the Air Force. You know, there's been a lot of discussions of the political ramifications of this legislation being pushed now. President Bush says he needs this to try people such as the man believed to be the mastermind behind the 9/11 attacks. What's your sense of what's happened?
Robin, I think this whole issue and this proposed legislation has become very politicized. There's no question that the administration was looking forward to the midterm election coming up on the 7th of November. It was very partisan in the handling of this. What is disturbing to many of us who are concerned about the safety of our own servicemen who will, I think, be affected by this piece of legislation if it's signed, is that nobody has really taken the time to go through each and every one of these provisions to see exactly what the effect is. Many changes were made this past weekend that were not a part of the, quote, compromise struck by the three Republican senators in the administration. So this bill that is about to be signed by the president goes almost back to the administration's first bill with a very draconian type of procedures as far as court stripping and interrogation techniques. So I wish that this had been slowed down and taken out of the political context, but I'm afraid that didn't happen.
Scott Silliman, a professor at Duke University School of Law and a retired military lawyer, retired judge advocate for the Air Force. Professor, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin. You know, I'm a Republican myself, Robin, and I've had to speak out on this because I think we have gone way too far. And if the men and women in uniform had the opportunity to speak out in a program like this, they cannot because they work for the president. I think they would share a lot of our concerns.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. And, you know, we just have a quick note here. We're going to stay in Washington, but on a much lighter note. Kazakh President Nursultan Nazarbayev is meeting with President Bush in Washington today. His visit, along with a massive public relations blitz, is aimed at improving the image of Kazakhstan and its leader. But more Americans may have heard of a fictional Kazakh. Borat is a TV reporter from Kazakhstan played by British comedian Sacha Baron Cohen, who has a movie coming out called Borat, Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan.
My name is Borat. I'm a journalist for Kazakhstan. My government sent me to USA to make a movie film. Please, you look. Please, you come see my film. If it's not success, I will be executed.
Yesterday, Secret Service agents turned Borat away from the White House gates. The Kazakh government has threatened the comic with a lawsuit for his portrayal of the country as home to donkey-beating anti-Semites who traffic in child prostitution. We just thought we'd just share that with you because who doesn't need a laugh on a Friday? Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Quick question. What do you think is the second biggest foreign aid program after the Middle East? It's probably not top of mind. It's the $4.7 billion program called Plan Colombia. Its goal is stopping the illicit coca trade in Colombia and neighboring countries. But the massacre of an elite U.S.-trained counter-narcotics unit in Colombia this past May is raising questions about the future of the aid plan. The elite police unit was allegedly gunned down by members of the Colombian military with ties to drug traffickers, and that pushed Congress to freeze funding for the anti-drug program. Donna Harmon is correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She writes about all of this in a terrific three-part series in the paper and joins us now. Donna, tell us first what happened that day in May in Hammond, Colombia. The massacre took place outside a hospital?
Yes, it's really a surreal story almost. It could be in a movie. Is that the top trained counter-narcotics police unit, trained by the DEA, vetted by them, you know, handpicked, trained over in the United States, they got a call to come to a psychiatric hospital out in the countryside, and their informant said that Diego Montoya, who is probably the biggest drug lord today in Colombia.
And second most wanted man in America behind Osama bin Laden.
Well, he's on the 10 most wanted FBI list,
mm-hmm.
exactly, with a $5 million bounty on his head.
Right.
So there was information that perhaps he was hiding out in this psychiatric hospital, so the team goes up to the hospital, drives up, and then comes to the front gate and calls on the residents inside, I guess, to open up, and then are immediately ambushed and killed. All of them shot in the back at quite close range, and most of them by the same sniper shot all of them. And then it turns out that it's a military unit, also outfitted and trained by the U.S., that's shot them.
And as you write today, these accused Colombian soldiers are in custody. They're accused of having ties to drug lords who set up this ACE counter-narcotic unit. But the prosecution has barely begun. In fact, you write the judge in the case passed it on to a military tribunal because he doesn't feel safe.
I noticed this story when I was there in May for the presidential elections. It was a very touchy time when this happened because it was about 2 days before the presidential elections. And at first they thought it was a case of friendly fire. Then they found text messages which completely implicated the military in having set up this ambush purposefully to kill this unit. And now they are in custody, and there are a couple hearings here and there. But it just is extremely slow process, and just it goes and halts and starts. And most recently, they're trying to get the case to a regular civilian court, but the civilian judge who is tapped indeed doesn't want to take the case. And he said straight out that he's afraid to take the case and he doesn't want to put his life at risk. So it goes on and on, and nothing is happening.
You quote U.S. Legislators, including our own congressman here in Massachusetts, Jim McGovern, who are furious about this. They say the U.S. is just pumping money without any oversight. He's asking questions like, how far have the drug mafias penetrated the Colombian military? The White House, on the other hand, the White House drug czar, says the U.S. is winning the war on drugs in the region. You've done a reality check, and it comes up with, it's kind of interesting because it's winning some battles and losing others. Tell us a little bit about what you found.
Well, that's right. And just to note that Jamundi isn't the only case that's been problematic. It's just been recently and now in the past few months a real catalyst for some critics saying, hey, is this plan working? We've put $4.7 billion into Plan Colombia since it started in 2000, and a lot of that has gone to training the military and the police. And those critics of the program say, look, we're training the military and the police, and the drug problem hasn't been resolved. We don't have less drugs on our street in the United States, especially cocaine, of which 90% arrives from Colombia. The purity and quality, nothing has changed. So in that regard, we haven't changed. And the country, Colombia, we're militarizing it, and now we're having our military people killing our police people. So there's a lot of anger about that. On the other hand, the White House drug czar's office would say that there are ways to measure success. And in some ways, they're right. They've eradicated hundreds of thousands of hectares of coca fields, and they've arrested a lot of drug lords. They've burned a lot of drug labs, etc. The problem seems to be is that all of this renews itself. There's just more and more hectares of coca planted. It's a very easy plant to grow. It can yield about six times a year. The people who are growing it are farmers who don't have a lot of other opportunities, and they just move once their fields are eradicated. A lot of them move to deeper into the forest. And so at the very end of the day, is there less cocaine in the United States? And the answer to that seems to be no.
And for people who are saying, well, you know, 'twas ever thus, I've got sort of fatigue, I'm paying more attention to Iraq right now, there's a stunning quote from the U.S. ambassador to Colombia, William Wood, that you include. He says 3,000 Americans a year die from Colombian drugs, and points out that's a World Trade Tower attack every year.
Well, yes, he does say that. And there's a lot of talk of those who want more attention on this issue that tries to compare the numbers to what's going on in the war on terror. But it's sort of evaporated from public discourse. There's a lot fewer international journalists based in Colombia. They're all moving to Venezuela, for example, where there's perhaps a more immediate story. And it just doesn't get a lot of attention.
Well, in fact, you have talked to experts and politicians, though, and asked them, what, you know, how could things be changed to make it better? And you write, there's often two different theories. Could you just briefly outline those for us? I mean, what are people thinking might be a better way to go?
Well, a lot of people I spoke to, especially people who are working through the UN, think that there's, and Europeans as well, think there should be much more of a stress on alternative development, because they say we eradicate all these fields, but then we don't give the farmers any options. So it's not a surprise that they go back to growing coca, because that's all they have. What we should do is we should help them with African palm, with bananas, with pineapples, whatever the case may be, and as well as with infrastructure so that once they grow those things, they can take it to the marketplace. We should invest a lot more in that sort of development. To counter that, the White House or the State Department would say, well, actually, you can't do one without the other. You can't start alternative development without security, and we're still working on the security aspect of it. So that's the counter argument. And the other school is what about the demand side? We're working and spending all this money to try and reduce supply coming into the United States, but there's always going to be a problem as long as there's a strong market, which there is here. And as long as people continue to want to use cocaine, there's going to be some way that someone is going to figure out a way to get it into the United States. So they're advocating for spending more of those funds on treatment and prevention and programs like that in the United States.
Donna Harmon, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Her three-part series in the Monitor about the $4.7 billion Plan Colombia, the effort to stop the illicit drug trade in the Colombia region, has been in the Monitor. The last part is today, but you can link to the whole series by going to our website, here-now.org. Donna, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Here and Now. This Monday, Jews around the world will be observing Yom Kippur, a holiday of atonement and repentance. So what does that have to do with Spider-Man? Well, according to one Orthodox rabbi from Brooklyn, a lot.
Whatever life holds in store for me, I will never forget these words. With great power comes great responsibility. This is my gift, my curse. Who am I? I'm Spider-Man.
According to Rabbi Simcha Weinstein, that scene from the original Spider-Man featuring Peter Parker, a.k.a. Spider-Man, can be seen through the lens of Jewish history. That's why Spider-Man and Superman and others are likely to crop up in the rabbi's sermon, and also why the Lubavitcher rabbi penned the newly released Up, Up, and Oyvey, How Jewish History, Culture, and Values Shaped the Comic Book Superhero. And Rabbi Weinstein joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be on the show, Robin.
Well, let's talk about that scene where Peter Parker, again, a.k.a. Spider-Man, realizes that he can't endanger his childhood love by marrying her because his life has to be dedicated to this greater good. How do you see that through a Jewish lens?
Well, if one thinks about it and one looks at the history of comic book superheroes, you'll find that many of the creators, if not all of the creators, writers, and illustrators behind the major superheroes were all Jewish. And they infused and influenced their characters with a particularly Jewish worldview. The creator of Spider-Man, Stan Lee, who was born actually Stanley Martin Lieber, just like his character, he also changed his name and has an alter ego. Spider-Man's catchphrase is, "With great power comes great responsibility." Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that's instilled within the Jewish people. And I talk about this within my sermons, even though the Jewish people are known to have a tremendous spiritual legacy and a wonderful biblical and cultural legacy, our blessing, sadly, has also become a curse. It involves a lot of guilt.
You also point to how Peter Parker became Spider-Man after he didn't stop a robber who proceeded to kill his uncle, and that he was struck by such guilt and remorse that he decided to spend the rest of his life fighting crime.
Spider-Man's motivation is that of guilt. And many commentators, such as Michael Chabon and the director of Spider-Man, Sam Raimi, who is in fact also Jewish, they themselves have said that this guilt seems to be that of a Jewish guilt. They also mentioned that Spider-Man lives in Forest Hills, Queens, which makes him somewhat of a Jewish character.
And Michael Chabon, you mentioned his award-winning fiction book, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, in which two Jewish 20-somethings, one of them a Holocaust survivor, make it big, illustrating superhero comic books. So he also has played on this theme. Tell us how you think it applies to Superman, because I'm thinking of the comic that you mentioned when Krypton explodes or is about to explode.
Superman is the creation of two Jews, Jerry Siegel and Joseph Shuster, who the first Superman issue appeared in Action Comics 1 in 1938. Superman is compared to Moses. Just as Moses is sent away in a reed basket, so too Superman himself is sent away in a rocket ship, a little pod. He grows up in a foreign culture, a foreign land, right. And both Moses and Superman become the people's savior, the people's hero. We can also draw a parallel between the tragic history of the Jewish people. The same period that Superman was created in the old country, in Germany, and for many Jews in Europe, their lives were literally, like Krypton, imploding.
You find in these comic strips the traditional Jewish themes of guilt and redemption, atrocity, justice, good prevailing over evil, hope, faith. But some would say, Rabbi, couldn't some of these themes apply to Christians?
Absolutely. One of the motivating factors for me to write the book was that I'd read 6 books by Christian writers proclaiming that the superheroes were in fact influenced by Christianity. But as a rabbi, knowing that the creators themselves were Jewish, I felt the pull to try and reclaim a vital part of Jewish cultural heritage.
And yet you do note that Jews might have the leg up on this debate in one other category. You quote Zeddy Lawrence, television writer of Dream Team, who points out, and I never thought of this before, if the word man appears at the end of someone's name, you can draw one of 2 conclusions. They're Jewish, as in Goldman, Feldman, or Lippman, or
they're Jewish, as in Batman, Spider-Man, and Superman.
Rabbi, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You're the Spider-Man. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Tonight, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 13 years ago, public radio listeners met a remarkable young man.
Guy standing on the corner burning the fire. Be here summertime, wintertime, spring, fall, every day. The drink in the hand, probably some white port.
That's Lee Allen Jones. Public radio producer David Isay followed him and his friend Lloyd Newman for 10 days to record their lives in Chicago's Ida B. Wells housing project. Since then, Isay's Sound Portraits production company has presented some of the most memorable moments on radio: a Jewish giant telling the story of the disease that made him tower over his parents, residents describing one of New York's last Skid Row hotels, and the controversial broadcast of a tape from a botched execution. David Isay was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship in 2000 and later launched StoryCorps, a soundproof booth set up at New York's Grand Central Station where passersby interviewed each other. In May of last year, the StoryCorps mobile booths hit the road, two Airstream trailers stopping across the U.S. to gather new chapters of America's oral history. Mobile booths are now in Little Rock, Arkansas, and right here in Boston, which is why David Isay is here as well to tell us more. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
We first talked to you when you launched this at Grand Central Station in New York.
Almost 3 years ago, yeah.
How's it going?
It's going really well. It's going beautifully well. I mean, we've now visited something like 50 cities in 35 states, and it's beautiful. People are the process of participating in StoryCorps really means a lot to people, and it's very, very gratifying and exciting to see.
I happened to be walking in Los Angeles one day visiting friends in the middle of the market, and there it was, the silver unit. Hi, you know,
yeah.
And people were in there telling their stories. Let's start off with one so we can get here just a sense of what you're gathering.
Sure.
This is Sam Harmon. He's telling his 12-year-old grandson about the saddest moment in his life.
Early in the Navy, I was stationed in Norfolk, Virginia. One day, my shipmates and I decided to come to Washington to visit the Capitol. While they were at the bars, I decided to sightsee. I'd walked around the monuments all day and was just tired out and decided that I would go to a movie, rest, and then pick them up later. And I went up to buy a ticket. There's a glass there. And off of the glass reflected the Capitol dome. And I just thought to myself, what a great way to end the day, drinking in all of this democracy. I call for the ticket. She was reading. She punched the machine. I reached my hand to get the ticket and lay down the money, and she pulled it back and said, "You can't come in here." She saw my black hand and refused to sell me a ticket. The Capitol dome was superimposed on her angry face, angered that I would have the temerity to ask to buy a ticket. And I just walked the streets crying all night.
Some of the sounds of StoryCorps. David Isay, I know you have a website and facilitators who can help people come up with questions that they can ask each other. But what's the one thing you'd tell people who participate?
The 40 minutes goes by very fast. Ask that one question you've always wanted to ask. Don't wait.
It's a great lesson in life in general. You know, ask that question you've always wanted to ask.
Well, and that's what StoryCorps is about. I mean, it's about taking 40 minutes with someone who you love, and by listening to them, telling them that you care about them and you love them. I mean, it's a way of honoring someone in your life.
StoryCorps has also followed some of the characters who recorded stories. Let's listen to Danny and Annie. Is it Parasa?
Parasa, yeah.
Interviewed together in May of 2005.
She started to talk, and I said, "Listen, I'm going to deliver a speech." I said, "At the end, you're going to want to go home." I said, "You represent a 34-letter word." I said, "That word is love." I said, "If we're going anywhere, we're going down the aisle, because I'm too tired, too sick, and too sore to do any other damn thing." And she turned around and she said, "Well, of course I'll marry you." And the next morning I called her as early as I possibly could.
And he always gets up early.
to make sure she hadn't changed her mind. And she hadn't. And every year on April 22nd around 3 o'clock, I call her and ask her if it was today, would she do it again? And so far the answer's been the same.
Yeah, 25 times yes.
David Isay, tell us about this couple, just so we get a sense of some of the people you've been meeting.
Sure. Danny was an OTB, an off-track betting clerk in New York, and Annie, his wife, and the love of his life, is a nurse in Brooklyn. And they came to StoryCorps and kind of fell in love with the project and ended up coming back over and over again. Danny would write letters to Annie every day, love letters to her, and they wanted to come in and read their letters. And Danny kind of became this character who would call the office and say, "You know, I had a cataract operation last week. Do you need me to come in and talk about it?"
Because what do you say? I mean, what does that tell you? One of the greatest moments I ever saw on television was when NBC News and then correspondent John Hart went to China. China first opened, and they were doing all the newsy pieces, and then he had the last piece on the program, and he was speaking to a man out in a village in China, an old man, and he was asking him, "What do you think about this? What do you think about that?" The man started to cry. He said, "Why are you crying?" And the old Chinese man said, "No one ever asked me what I thought before."
Well, that's StoryCorps. Yeah. I mean, I think what, you know, Danny was this guy who you know, he was 5 feet tall, bald, cross-eyed, no teeth. And, you know, people would laugh at him on the street. And these tapes that he made with his wife were so powerful. And it was a way for, you know, StoryCorps tells people that they matter and they're not going to be forgotten. And Danny felt that in a very deep way.
Danny passed away this past spring?
Yeah, he passed away in March. Hmm. And Annie got something like 2,000-plus condolence letters from public radio listeners. Yeah. Instead of getting a letter from Danny every day, she reads a letter from a public radio listener.
Isn't that something? It's also so increasingly hard to get. I mean, for decades now, there's been this sort of co-option of storytelling to pull the heartstrings, to take other people's stories for some sort of voyeuristic entertainment. And, you know, these don't do that. Why don't they do that? You know what I'm saying? How do you avoid that?
I don't think that there's nobody who comes to StoryCorps because they want to be famous. You know, I think people come to StoryCorps to honor someone who they care about. So I think it just comes from a very authentic and real place. And I hope that we're in kind of the first pitch of the first inning of a very long game with StoryCorps. I mean, it's only been a year that we've been national, and, you know, people know about us now, but I hope this is only the beginning. And what we hope to do with StoryCorps is kind of start a social movement of getting people to listen to each other and appreciate one another's stories and make it part of the fabric of this country.
Sound Portraits founder and executive producer David Isay. There is a StoryCorps mobile booth in Little Rock, Arkansas, one right here in Boston, Massachusetts now. So for more on the schedule, might be coming to your town, visit here-now.org. And we'll leave you with one of the unexpected moments that can happen when you step inside one of those silver booths. Here's a young couple. They started off talking about their saddest moment, and it turned into quite a different one.
So what was the most emotionally painful thing that ever happened?
My father passing away, of course. It was sudden, and he was supposed to pick me up from the airport. And I got to the airport, and I called my house, and my mother said, you know, your aunt's going to pick you up. Obviously, I could detect something in her voice. There's no way that you could hide that. And she told me that he died in the middle of the night. I stood there and watched the bags go around the carousel. I felt like no other time in my life. So this is the ring that my father gave to my mother. And he saved up and he purchased this and he proposed to my mother with this. And so I thought that I would give it to you so that he could be with us for this also. Deborah, will you please marry me?
Yeah, of course. I love you.
So, kids, this is how your mother and I got married, in a booth in Grand Central Station, with my father's ring. My grandfather was a cab driver for 40 years, used to pick people up here every day, so it seems right.
I'm supposed to talk after that? Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a wonderful weekend. And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.